be around when they do. After the stairs are taped, Essie and her father practice walking down the center aisle. A photographer snaps some pictures as they make their way forward, and I try to imagine on which magazine covers those shots might eventually end up. I work on coming up with pithy headlines to fill the time, since Essie and her father have quite a distance to cover before I can even see them clearly. When they get closer, I notice that Essie is carrying a bouquet of some sort in both hands. It looks like flowers, but also not like flowers. I strain my eyes to get a better look. Somehow Caleb senses my question and says, "Naomi made it for her. First she dyed the paper red, and then she cut and glued the pieces to look like roses. She used sheet music from all the solos that Essie's ever sung in church." I'm actually touched, and feeling that way because of Caleb makes my skin crawl. I know from Essie that Naomi is an only child, but always wanted a sister. It seems to me that this bouquet, if nothing else, is for Essie and not for the cameras. That's quite a gesture. It must have taken her ages to finish. Well, it's not as big as she would have liked. Naomi is not one to do things halfway. If she'd had more time, Essie would have been trailing paper roses. Huh. Naomi sounds like quite a woman. That sort of dedication, it's not something you should take for granted. Caleb looks taken aback by this. "We aren't going to have a problem here, are we?" He glances down at Blake and Reggie, who are whispering something to Rand, and clearly not listening to anything we say. I raise my eyebrows, enjoying his discomfort. "A problem? Why would we?" I only meant to say that Essie is lucky to have someone like Naomi looking out for her. At this point, I have to step forward and wait for Pastor Hicks to place Essie's hand in mine. No doubt to symbolize the transfer of ownership over her, or something equally misogynistic. But first, he kisses her on the cheek, and I'm surprised to see the tears in his eyes. I nod to him gravely and take Essie's hand. Then Pastor Hicks turns his back to us and faces his imaginary congregation. From the floor at the base of the stairs, he says something about how we should be still while he welcomes everyone and has them rise for the first hymn. He stands motionless for a moment, as if running through exactly what he intends to say, arms spread out in the air, and then drops his hands to his side, gives a barely perceptible bow, and walks up the stairs to the left of the altar to face us again, this time from above. We hurry through the remainder of the ceremony. Essie pledges herself to me. I pantomime slipping a ring on her finger. We kiss. Everyone claps, and the sound echoes through the empty vault of the nave, a word I recently learned from Essie. I'm amazed at the noise made by a few pairs of hands being brought together, how each staccato burst ricochets across the emptiness and is amplified without a thousand bodies there to absorb it. I walk Essie back down the aisle while Candy calls after us not to rush, no matter how excited we might be to start our life together. Essie rolls her eyes and walks a little faster, practically dragging me along. I look back at Candy and shrug helplessly and hear her say, "I guess there's no doubt who's going to wear the pants in that relationship." Once we reach the back of the church, Essie starts to giggle, and I squeeze her hands and start to laugh as well. I can hear Caleb and Naomi, who are next in line to exit the church, closing in on us, their footsteps getting nearer. Impulsively, I draw Essie closer and turn her shoulders so we are facing. I touch my lips to hers again, but not the way I had on the steps when her father declared us almost husband and wife. This time, I really kiss her, and I try to make it the sort of kiss that girls write about in their diaries, the sort of kiss we pay to see in movies, The sort of kiss I hope to get someday. It's not fair what I'm doing. I know it even as I explore Essie's mouth with my tongue. But I'm thinking only that Caleb will see this, and that seeing this will show him that his power over her is finished. Knowing how much this will hurt him feels more right than kissing Essie feels wrong. Beneath my touch, Essie's shoulders tense as I slide one hand up to her chin, and then her body relaxes against me. I kiss her until she drops the bouquet of paper roses. It rolls away from us across the floor. Then I pull away. When we turn, Naomi has picked up the bouquet and is holding it out in one limp hand. It's clear at once that it's ruined, the petals crushed. Some are even torn. The color drains from Essie's face, which only a moment earlier had been flushed. Naomi, I'm so sorry. I shouldn't have been so careless, she exclaims. Naomi tries to hide her hurt, but without success.
No, it's fine. It's just this one side. I might be able to fix it.
She blinks quickly and lifts the hand that holds the bouquet to draw an arm across her eyes to dry them. Essie reaches out to touch her shoulder. But Naomi shivers and turns away. Don't worry about it, sis, Caleb says to Essie, all the while keeping his eyes on me. These things happen. Sure they do, I answer, making sure to meet his gaze directly. Especially to things that are so delicate. You let your guard down just for a second, and everything you work so hard to create ends up completely destroyed. Caleb puts an arm around Naomi, but doesn't look away. I smirk and take Essie by the hand and pull her toward the stairs. She follows wordlessly as we walk down to the basement and into one of the choir rooms. But I can feel her anger even as we move.
Fuck you, Rourke!
Essie yells at me when the door is closed behind us. Is this about that stupid flower thing? I say, trying to sound glib. Essie's face is tear-stained. I look at my shoes, abashed. I hadn't heard her crying. I hadn't thought that she would cry.
It's not about the flowers, and you know it. You have no right to kiss me like that.
She's the one who has no right to kiss you like that, I counter.
Neither of you do. Don't you see that? Don't you see that how you just treated me isn't any different from how he treats me? I was your prop. I was there to help you make your point. It was about you and what you wanted entirely. It was like I wasn't even there. You said that there would be kissing. I gave you kissing. What's the problem?
I'm being mean and I know it. But I don't care. Essie looks at a loss, but then she says,
because it felt like you actually meant it. We were supposed to try to fool everyone else, not try to fool each other.
Suddenly, all I want is for this fight to be over, even if it means having to admit that I was wrong. I sit down on one of the choir's folding chairs. You're right. I'm sorry.
I know,
she tells me, and sits beside me. He has to pay, I answer. You know he has to pay.
He will. I have a plan.
Essie tells me about the book she's written, or about the book that Libby has written or is writing. It seems it's still a work in progress. She tells me about how, for the last 2 years, she typed up bits and pieces of her diaries anytime she had access to a computer, knowing that her laptop at home was likely being monitored based on something Gretchen once said. Gretchen had echoed part of a line from a poem that Essie had written for English. She had shown the poem to nobody, but she had typed it into her computer. And right then, Essie knew that there was nothing private in her life. She had already known this in theory. She had just not known how deep the surveillance went. Not long after Gretchen's slip, Bessie took one of the diaries out of the secret compartment Lissa had helped her cut into the back wall of her closet, and smuggled it out of the house wrapped in a dirty soccer shirt. That's when she started transcribing. She worked on it at school, or at Lily's house, and even once at Caleb and Naomi's, when she was babysitting. When she was done with that diary, a thin volume with a unicorn on the cover, she retrieved another. And another. And another. Until she had 6 years of her life transferred onto a flash drive that she kept ferreted away in a tampon container in the bottom of her backpack. There was another buried in her backyard. Now she had given one of those flash drives to Libby. Or she had left it somewhere and then Libby had found it. I didn't quite understand that part. But what was important was that the book was ready. She said we should have an electronic copy later that night. All we had to do then was decide to publish it. We, Essie and I. I didn't tell you before because even when I left the flash drive for Libby to find, I wasn't entirely sure I wasn't crazy. It was possible that everything I had written was completely incoherent, and I was worried that maybe Libby would read through it all and tell me there was nothing there worth reading. Nothing there that anyone outside this family would want to know. I didn't want you to agree to marry me, expecting some big reveal to the public, some dramatic moment of truth, and then be left with nothing. Be left with only me. Let me just make sure I understand you. What's in this book is everything that ever happened. Everything that Caleb did to you. Not in lurid detail, but yes, it's there. I sit with this for a minute, then I say, what exactly do you expect will happen when that all goes public? I'm not saying I don't see what the appeal will be for people. They will buy it. Man, will they buy it. And you'll make some money. We, she reminds me, we will make a lot of money. So much more than we have already. And that's why you're doing it? Essie shakes her head. No, of course not. It's never been about the money. Not really. What is it about then? Getting even? Getting out? Essie looks thoughtful, draws her bottom lip beneath the top one. Maybe a little bit of both. But I think mostly that I just want to get to a place in my life where I can say out loud, this is what happened. And not have to hide from it anymore. Not have to be ashamed. He's the one who should be ashamed, not me. I take Essie's hand and draw it into my lap. There are footsteps out in the hall. They grow louder and then they trail away again. I listen to make sure they're gone, still uncertain what to say. Then slowly I offer. He should be ashamed. We both know that. It's not that I disagree with you. Please don't think that. But I guess I just want to know what you think will happen after everyone buys the book. After they read it? After Caleb raping you becomes all that anyone can talk about? At least for a little while. What happens then? Does he go to jail? Do you press charges? Or does the state, since you're a minor? Do you expect your parents to renounce him? Do you really think they'll be on your side after everything they've always done to keep this quiet? Everything Mother's done, you mean? The things she said that make it clear she thinks of this as my fault, not his? I shouldn't have tempted Caleb? I should have known how to keep him away. But the wedding was her idea, not my father's. I was eavesdropping when it was decided. Maybe Daddy just went along. Maybe he didn't know, Essie says uncertainly. You don't believe that, I tell her gently. Well, then they both deserve whatever fire and brimstone comes their way.
Fine, I say. Again, it's not that I don't agree with you. It's just that I want to make sure you've thought about it. And not just from your viewpoint or from mine, but from everybody else's. Because if you do this, there will be no going back. It will be out there forever. And this baby of yours, of ours, will never be able to escape from that.
Essie stands. Would you rather that I lie? That we pretend that you're the father? I spread out my arms and lean back in my chair. I thought that was the plan. I thought that was why you needed me.
That was why I was allowed to need you. At least as far as Mother was concerned, but that wasn't ever what I really wanted.
She crosses to the piano, plunks out a few notes, and pulls the cover over the keys. I stand and face her, the piano between us, and ask, "So what do you want?" And remember, Essie, I will be this child's father, no matter what you choose. I already promised that. Whether or not he or she knows the truth or some other kinder, redacted version of all this, I'll be there. You just need to decide what it is you want. She sits down on the piano bench and leans her face against the instrument, then closes her eyes. I almost don't hear her when she finally speaks.
What if I still don't know?
We drive together to the rehearsal dinner, which is basically a pre-game wedding reception, since all of the out-of-town family and friends have been invited. Essie continues to look troubled on the drive over, twisting her hands in her skirt or tapping her foot against the door. I let her fidget and don't press her to talk. She seems a little less distant once she's enveloped by a swarm of friends and relations. It seems everyone has come out of the woodwork for this event. Even so, I can tell that her heart's not in it. Her eyes don't really light up again until she spots her cousin Adam, whose late father Cyrus was Celia Hicks's brother in that other life she had before. Essie tells me that Adam is a sophomore at NYU, and he excitedly begins to recite a list of places we have to visit once we're living in New York. Where to get the best pizza, or the most authentic Ethiopian food, how to wrangle free tickets to plays or musicals or museums. Not long after Essie has introduced us, she excuses herself and heads toward the ladies' room. Adam asks me what I'm thinking of studying at Columbia, and then tells me about one of his professors this semester, who seems like he's drunk more often than he's sober, how he once fell off the stage at the front of the lecture hall. I laugh, and then before I have even really finished laughing, Adam tells me, "It's been really nice talking with you. Seriously, man, thanks for playing the gracious host and all, but don't you think you'd better move on, mingle? I'm fine by myself. You know what they'll think of you if you spend too much time with me." I try to work out if this is part of the joke about the drunk professor, but for the life of me can't figure out what the punchline is supposed to be. What will they think of me? Well, it won't be so much a thought as a feeling. You'll be contaminated as far as they're concerned. The stain will pass to you from me. This isn't really an explanation, and I manage a half-hearted chuckle and spread my hands and say, "I honestly have no idea what you're talking about. These people are my family, but that doesn't mean I can't call out stupid when I see it. They've been avoiding me ever since I came out, so I was probably only invited because welcoming me back into the fold will make an excellent topic for one of Uncle Jethro's sermons. It'll be about hating the sin and not the sinner, or some such doublespeak." "Since you're gay," I say, testing out the combination of words as a statement rather than an insult. He stares at me for a moment, as if reconsidering, then says,
Are you sure you got into Columbia?
You're not so quick on the uptake. I must look embarrassed because Adam quickly claps a hand on my shoulder and says, "It's all right, man." I assumed that Essie had told you. There's no reason you should have known. Our ability to masquerade as straight has allowed us to infiltrate the enemy camp on more than one occasion. It's one of the driving themes of the gay agenda.
You're joking,
I say, though suddenly I'm not entirely sure.
Of course I am.
My shoulder is warm beneath the weight of Adam's hand, and the heat lingers even after he removes it.
Anyway,
he says, as he lifts his glass to his lips. I totally understand if you want to bail. No need to feed the gossip mill. I scan the room. Celia Hicks is fawning over an older, well-dressed cousin from Florida with a small dog in her purse. Pastor Hicks is not far away, surrounded by a group of women from the parish. He has his back to the wall, and it almost looks like he's been trapped by wild animals. A small part of me feels sorry for him. A very small part. Over on the other side of the room, Caleb moves through the crowd, stopping every so often to shake hands as if this is a campaign event. We're so close to the end that I can almost taste it. But all at once, I'm tired, and I don't have the energy to play their games. Not for the next 15 minutes or so, at least. Swallowing hard, I pull out the stool next to Adam's and sit. Actually, I'm fine right here.
Esther. I am still angry with Rourke when we walk into the rehearsal dinner. Not as angry as I had been when he was kissing me, or in the moments right after we broke apart, but I can still feel it. The resentment. The powerlessness at being touched in a way that was not wanted. Again. It was not the same. Not exactly, but it was not really all that different in the end. Rourke at least had apologized. That was something Caleb had never done. Not even that first time when he left me bleeding. The closest he ever came to saying he was sorry was when he left a bruise he knew would show. But he did not sound sorry even when he said the word. He sounded defiant. He sounded proud. I think I would have let the anger linger. I would have wallowed. Except that almost as soon as we walk into the function room, I see my cousin Adam. I can tell just from looking at him that he does not want to be here. He does not look uncomfortable, he just looks bored. Bored with all the whispers, the looks, the need for constant vigilance. And who can blame him, really? If I'd had the option, I would have stayed away as well. But he had come anyway because I asked, even though he had planned to let his mother come on her own. So I bring Rourke to Adam and introduce them, and then I walk away because I think that what I need is to be alone, even just for a few minutes, to finally let that anger go. They are laughing when I look back from the other side of the room, their bodies angled toward each other. And for a moment I feel my anger swell again. Then I remind myself that Rourke, too, is here only because I asked him. I asked? And he said yes. He would have been fine all on his own. I'm certain of it. Sure, he would not have been able to afford Columbia, but he would have managed. He would have washed dishes or delivered pizzas or tutored rich high schoolers in order to pay for state. He would have been happy. He would have graduated and become a doctor or a lawyer or an investment banker. He would have made all the money he could ever need entirely on his own. And he would have done it all without ever having to walk into this pit of vipers I have led him to, without risking everything for a girl he barely knew. All at once I realize something, and I feel the anger fall away. The kiss entirely forgiven, if not forgotten. Rourke is the first real friend I've ever had. the only one who has ever really known me. And that means something. It means that he never needed me the way that I needed him. Libby is standing just inside the entrance to the function hall when I come out of the bathroom. I catch a glimpse of her through the throng. I cut around the periphery to avoid the bodies, and she raises a hand to indicate that she's seen me coming and then ducks back outside. It is raining, but only just. A sort of mist floats over the parking lot, moving neither up nor down, but swirling gently from side to side, illuminated by the lights of a car that is parked nearby. Libby walks toward the car, and the lights cut out. A young man climbs from behind the wheel and stands with one hand atop the open door, ready to make a getaway if one is needed. He shifts nervously, his eyes on Libby, which is when I realize just how on edge Libby looks herself. When she leans against the hood of the car to face me, she does not meet my eyes. Her fingers drum on the metal beneath her hips, tapping to some inner melody that I cannot hear. What happened? Did someone find out what we're planning? I do not realize until I hear my own voice how terrified I am. I remember then how, when I was about 9 years old, a man had tried to break in through the kitchen window. He had a camera. Daddy was in the papers a lot at that point, even more than now. Some question about his tax returns. Eventually, it was buried, but for a brief but memorable span of a few months, there was great interest in capturing candid pictures of our unscripted, off-television life. Most of the time, the paparazzi left us alone. There were too many pictures of us already out there. Anything extra just wouldn't be likely to sell. But this period of time was different for some reason. They wanted to catch us eating with diamond-encrusted forks, slurping soup with golden spoons. There was a sudden and burning interest in just how we lived, how much we spent, how much was taken from Daddy's various ministries and quietly skimmed off the top. Just as quickly, the press lost interest. But not before the man with the camera climbed through the window over the kitchen sink. Lissa locked us in an office in the basement, and then she called 911. The recording of that call starts as soon as the three numbers were dialed, even before the operator picked up. Later, when the detectives played us the tape, you could hear Lissa's ragged breathing, and another sound. A muffled whimper that was me crying from beneath Candy's desk. When the operator did speak, Lissa answered with forced calm, but you could tell that her voice was breaking. It is that voice of Lissa's that I hear when I speak to Libby, worried that we've come this far only to fail, to be found out. The finish line erased now that it is finally in sight.
No, no. Libby tells me hurriedly, nothing like that. No one's found out anything. At least they haven't found out from me, but we need to talk about this book you've written.
You mean it's finished? Can I see it? Do you have it here? Libby nods slowly and takes a flash drive from her pocket and holds it out to me.
I have it, and of course you can see it. It's your story after all. And it's a good one, too, as stories go. It has a beginning, a middle, and an end. It has a villain and a heroine. I'm grateful that you shared it with me. I'll even upload it for sale if that's what you ask me to do. But maybe this is where it all should stop.
I don't understand.
This will destroy your family, Essie. Not just Caleb. All of them. It will be the end of everything if this ever gets out.
I know that.
I don't think you do.
Libby holds the flash drive higher and turns it as if to examine the object from all sides.
You think you've thought it through. You think your mind has teased out all of the many potential repercussions, but it's just not possible to do that. It's not possible to predict every eventuality, or to imagine each of the million tiny ways the people you once cared about will be hurt by what it is you plan to do. So, I'm here to give you this. But I'm also here to tell you that I think you should bury it. Put it in the back of your underwear drawer or in a safe deposit box somewhere, but keep it hidden. The things that are in this story, they aren't things you want the whole world to know. I stiffen. Then I reach out and snatch the flash drive from Libby's hand. It wasn't my fault, I tell her. Libby looks down. She pulls at the lining of her coat where it has separated from the seam and begun to wear. I know, she answers in a small voice. But that doesn't matter. Sometimes the truth is blamed on whoever was unlucky enough to deliver it. Trust me, I know. If you put this out there, if you make that choice, then everything that comes after, all of that, will be on you. Not him. It isn't fair, I say, my eyes filling with tears. Libby straightens and begins to move around to the passenger side door. Of course it isn't fair. It was never going to be, from the very beginning. Fair was something Caleb took from you, along with everything else. You're fooling yourself if you think there's a way to get that back. She looks across the car at the man standing there, who has not moved at all while we spoke. We should go, she tells him. No, he answers. Not until you tell her the truth. The air I suck into my lungs is wet and heavy and makes me feel as if I am drowning. What truth? Libby asks him. Her eyes are flashing. The truth about how none of this has anything to do with her or with her family. It has to do with yours. That's no one's business, Libby spits. My whole body is trembling, and I feel the shaking grow more violent as they fight. What? You don't think it's the tiniest bit relevant to the matter at hand? You told the truth, and something bad happened, and now you blame yourself. But the real truth is bigger than that. The real truth is that there were times that I thought not telling would kill you. That right there is what you're asking her to do. She pays a price whether she buries the book or not. As he says this, I can practically see Libby's anger melt away, and his own furrowed brow gives way to tenderness and worry. I wouldn't have let it kill me, she says. Maybe not physically, but there are other ways a person can die. I speak mostly to remind them that I am there, but it is possible that I am talking to myself. What should I do? The man shrugs as if deciding how to answer. Maybe you can keep the secret forever and not let it eat you up inside. Libby couldn't. I was watching her suffer and I couldn't stand it. The truth had to come out, no matter the consequences. Maybe it would be different for you. Maybe you could walk away and manage to be happy. Maybe you could hold on to the pieces of your past that were good and just let go of all the rest. But that's easier said than done. If the truth will out, so to speak, you might as well get it over with and move on to the real hard part. What's that? I ask him. Putting the pieces back together again. I am not conscious of walking back into the function room. I remember being outside. I remember watching the brake lights of Libby's car as it pulled away, so startled that I no longer felt like crying. I splashed water from an ornamental fountain in the garden onto my puffy eyes, patted them dry using my shawl. Then I faced the entrance, knowing that I had to go back to the party, but not able to take a step toward the door. Even when I do force myself to go inside, a sort of blur continues to hang around me. Everything feels out of focus. Then Mother takes the microphone and calls out for someone to dim the lights. Y'all will have to bear with me, Mother is saying from her place beneath the spotlight. I'm not really one for public speaking. It should be Jethro up here instead, but he'll have his chance tomorrow. In the meantime, you'll have to make do with me. There are several shouts of protest, some scattered clapping to reassure my mother that she is adored just as deeply as her husband, which I know is exactly what she wants. She blushes and waves her hand up and down in front of her as if to quiet the crowd, which only makes them cheer all that much louder. Mother laughs and raises the microphone to her lips again. Settle down now. Let's save some of this enthusiasm for the reception tomorrow. I'm told it's going to be one heck of a party. There is more clapping, and then the audience, as if on cue, falls silent almost all at once. Mother passes a hand over her eyes to collect herself and then starts to speak again. There have been other weddings before this one. Other couples have stood up in front of their families, in front of God himself, and pledged to carry his light onward together. I've been lucky to watch my own four sons marry four of the most beautiful and supportive women a mother could dream of for her children. I've watched our family grow in love with the birth of each grandchild, and I can truly say that with the passing of each year, we have only become more and more blessed. Which brings us to today. I thought I would be up here to talk about Elizabeth long before I had to get ready to say goodbye to Esther Ann. But it seems our Lord had other plans. It also seems likely that given how adept Elizabeth has become at dodging the cameras, when the time does come for her to tie the knot, she'll do it without letting any of us know. There are a few good-natured snickers at this, and Lissa, who I see now has settled herself next to Rourke and Adam, stands and curtsies primly. The laughter swells and some people start clapping. So instead, Mother continues, raising her voice to cut through the applause, I'm here to talk to you about Esther Ann, the baby of the family who is not a baby anymore. She waits for the crowd to provide the expected aww and then moves on. And because this is a wedding, I'm also here to talk to you about Rourke, the young man my daughter has chosen to navigate this world alongside. A worthy companion for what I am sure will be an exciting trip. I could not ask for two finer people to honor here tonight. But they were not always the self-assured young adults you'll see exchanging vows tomorrow. And if you'll indulge me for just a few minutes more, I'd like to take you on a journey back in time. A journey through the lives of these two young people I know we've all come to love. The spotlight cuts out then, and a projector illuminates both Mother and the wall behind her. Mother blinks furiously and scurries quickly to the side. Music starts. It is a song I remember Daddy singing when I was young, his voice gentle and drawling, coaxing me to sleep on long car rides or in the hammock out by the lake. There is a slide with our names on it, Rourke's and mine. And then the pictures start to flash before us. Rourke as a tiny scrunched-up ball of brand-new baby, me wearing a christening gown. There are other people in some of the pictures. I recognize younger versions of Rourke's mother and father, and some of the relatives I've met today. There are team photos from Little League, a shot of Rourke with several friends wearing matching t-shirts that say Bement, that looks to have been taken at a summer camp. He gets older as the slideshow continues. And so do I. The projector dims, and the next picture appears. I am front and center in a group photo of Daniel and Hillary on their wedding day. Both Lissa and I had been flower girls. We wear matching pale pink dresses with puffy sleeves and ruffled trims. I am smiling, and not just for the camera. I remember being happy. It had something to do with the necklace I am wearing in the picture. They are real pearls. It is still one of my favorites. Lissa had been given one as well, but she had refused to wear it to the wedding, which made Mother angry. I was glad, though. I liked having something that made me special, something that made me beautiful, something that made me stand out on my own. But I see now that I am not the only one wearing that necklace in the picture. Naomi is wearing one as well. And I remember something that I had somehow forgotten. It was Naomi who had given it to me, shyly, the first time that we met. A present for her boyfriend's younger siblings, the girls she hoped to someday call sisters of her own. After that, All I can seem to focus on are how many of the pictures show me with Naomi. We are riding on a tandem bicycle along the dirt road near the lake house, or baking cookies, or lying on the beach on sandy towels, a tangle of tanned arms and legs. I am reminded then of how fiercely I had loved her in the time before. Her hair, her smile, everything about her was perfect as far as I was concerned. I made up excuses to sit next to her at family dinners or, in order to put off saying goodnight, would offer to carry her purse out to their car. Even in the time that came after, there are pictures of me holding Millicent on the day she was born and reading Blueberries for Sal to Nate while he fell asleep on my lap. These make me think about what Libby's friend had said before he left, how there was goodness mixed in with all the bad. When the slideshow is finished, I can still see the after image of that rectangle of light when I close my eyes. I sigh. It is one thing to ruin Caleb, or even Mother and Daddy. It is another thing entirely to ruin the life of Naomi. Someone who loves me. Someone who has never done me any harm. When we get home, I tell Mother that I am tired, and I go to my bedroom and shut the door. I change quickly and turn off the light. Then I read until my eyes are burning, and it is impossible to keep the text in focus as it dances across the screen. It is not until my stomach rumbles that I realize I did not eat anything at the rehearsal dinner. Rubbing at my face, I exhale slowly and close the file, pull out the flash drive and slip it into the pocket of my pajama pants. I crack the door to my room and listen before I venture out into the hall, then head down the stairs. Before I can make for the kitchen, I hear a noise from the darkened parlor. It is just the whisper of air as it is forced out of a cushion, but it is enough to let me know that someone is there. I stop in the doorway and examine the shadow. Not Mother, which is a relief, but still odd, since the parlor is her domain. Instead, it is my father sitting there. I try to remember the last time we were alone together, and can't. I consider moving on without saying anything, but somehow I know that even though he has not acknowledged me, he would call after me if I turned away. So I take a step forward and into the room. "Daddy?" I say softly. "What are you doing down here? Does Mother know you're up?" He continues to look out the window without answering, and I bend over slightly so that I can see what he sees. The streetlight and the clouds parting to reveal the moon.
"Your mother is asleep," he manages finally. "Something about looking fresh for tomorrow. You should follow her lead. You only have one wedding day."
He turns away from the window and I feel his gaze slide over my face as if memorizing it, and then his eyes reluctantly break away. He looks sad, and I feel the urge to comfort him, and immediately the anger from earlier this evening returns, because shouldn't it be the other way around? Shouldn't he be comforting me? I stay silent, waiting. If ever there were a time for questions, this is it. But I find that there is nothing that I want answered. Or rather, I do not want the answers if it means I have to ask. I do not want to sound like I am begging. I do not want to admit that he has the power here. Daddy absently twists his wedding band around his finger, looking down at his hands as if surprised to find that they belong to him. Then he looks out the window again.
"Your mother, when she gets her heart set on something, well, there was nothing I could say. She wanted you married, so you're going to be married. Goodness only knows what put that idea in her head, but here we are nonetheless."
He looks truly at a loss, and I feel the anger all over again. Even if Mother has not told him directly, how could he fail to guess? "I'm pregnant," I say in a moment of pique. Daddy absorbs this as if the revelation is an actual physical blow.
Jesus,
he breathes. I don't think Jesus had anything to do with it. He looks at me again, his eyebrows drawn together.
No, I don't suppose he did.
I do nothing to interrupt the silence, but instead lift my chin slightly in what I hope he will register as defiance. But he does not look at me.
I did my best,
he says finally.
I tried to head things off. The summer after you were born, there was an incident with a cat. He helped make posters to hang up all around the neighborhood. Elizabeth did as well. But the cat wasn't missing. It was dead. I hoped that might be the worst of it, but we both know what happened next.
I hold my breath, then say, Lyssa, is that what you mean? Is Lyssa what happened next?
The director at Holden Park told us we wouldn't have anything else to worry about. Not after he finished out the program there. They promised he was safe.
He wasn't.
No, he wasn't.
There are so many things that are left unsaid, but it does not matter. The only thing that matters is that he had known about Caleb all along. I stand in the door while I pull enough air into my lungs to speak. I forgive you, I tell my father. Then, no longer hungry, I climb the stairs and squeeze the flash drive in one clenched fist as I fall asleep.
Rourke. The suit they buy me to get married in is Armani. I've never felt anything so soft in my entire life. Blake and Reggie strut around the room in the church basement that we've been given to get ready in before the ceremony, like they're preparing for the red carpet. Rand rolls up one of the paper programs printed for the service and holds it out to them like it's a microphone and asks them questions about their shoes and hair. Caleb's still off with Naomi somewhere, so we have the room to ourselves. And I feel relaxed. Excited, even. There's a knock at the door, and I hear my father's voice coming from the hall.
Is everyone decent?
He calls and forces a chuckle. The door opens a crack and he peeks inside and then throws it open wider. My mom is standing beside him. She looks unsure of herself, almost as if she's afraid she will be told that she has no right to be here. I open the door fully to let them in, but they take only a few steps inside the room.
Just wanted to check if you boys were okay,
Mom says timidly.
Not too nervous.
She reaches out to brush an invisible piece of lint from my lapel, then touches the tip of one finger to the single white lily fastened there. She considers the flower, lips pressed together thinly, and allows her hand to drift back to her side. It moves as if disconnected from intent. A boat caught up in a current. And it occurs to me that this is how my mother herself must feel. Moving from wave to wave and out to deeper waters without a rudder. Powerless to avoid being smashed up against the rocks. Her wrist turns once, quickly, a spasm, and then falls still again.
We're fine, ma'am, Blake answers for me.
Aren't we?
Blake claps a hand on my arm and jostles me back to my senses. I blink and look away from Mom's watery eyes and over toward my father. They are both dressed well for the occasion. The clothes are nicer than anything they would ever buy on their own. Mom's hair has been curled and pinned up in a complicated arrangement, upon which sits a small round hat festooned with pieces of netting and feathers, dyed to match her dress. I've never seen my mother in this sort of hat before. I wonder if this is by choice or because it never occurred to her.
It's probably the latter.
But it's also possible that there are pictures of such hats in her box, the one that is filled with magazine clippings of other people's kitchens, other people's children playing in other people's yards, elderly couples lounging on the porch in matching rockers. Maybe this hat is what Mom wanted all along, but could never even hope to wish for. Until now.
Dad coughs, and I can tell by how he looks at me that we are thinking the same thing.
I'm proud of you, son, he tells me. Not just today, but always.
Thanks, Dad, I answer. Mom begins to cry.
Don't, I say. You'll ruin your makeup.
Of course, she says, and opens her eyes wide and inhales deeply.
You're right. How silly.
They reach out to touch me one more time, and I hear the shutter of a camera sliding open and shut as an unseen photographer captures this moment for posterity. And then my parents leave me behind. I spend the next 15 minutes or so with Libby. It turns out that Blake and Reggie, and Rand as well, have been looking forward to this more than I realized. Liberty Bell is something of a fantasy for them, it seems. They have never met a celebrity whose last name wasn't Hicks. Rand practices some lines of small talk and asks Blake and Reggie how he should stand. As their excitement builds, I feel a sudden urge to protect Libby from this overzealousness. But when she enters the room, Rand is polite. They all are. Their voices are a bit too loud, their faces clownishly animated. But there's nothing gross about the way they look at her. And I'm relieved. Libby asks me how I'm feeling, while Margot holds us in frame and zooms in on our faces. When we're finished, Libby leans in close and whispers, "Have you spoken to Essie?" I shake my head. "No, not since last night. Not since the beginning of the party. We sort of lost track of each other after that. Why?" Libby fumbles with her microphone. She looks unused to holding it. For all of our other interviews, we've been mic'd, and we will be today, during the ceremony. But she'll have to use this again when she interviews us outside. "It's nothing. I said something I shouldn't have, I think. I pushed too hard where it wasn't my place. I was hoping that we would get a chance to talk just now, but the other girls were there. It's all right. I'll find her after." I nod as if I understand what she's saying, but I don't. Not really. "Was Lissa there?" I ask. Libby laughs, and her face clears as if the other thing is forgotten. "She was there, and she has them all wrapped around her little finger, from what I saw." They could hardly stop giggling long enough for Essie to film her segment. Celia Hicks didn't look too pleased by the scene when she came in, which I think only added to Lissa's enjoyment.
"That sounds about right," I say. "Families are complicated like that."
"You're right. It's not just this one,"
Libby agrees. She looks sad, but it passes quickly, and she gives my hand a squeeze and wishes me luck. Margot comes over then and wraps her arms around me. She holds me tight, and for a long time, but it's not uncomfortable. When she pulls away, there are tears in her eyes.
"You're one of the good ones, Rourke Richards. I hope you know that. A prince among men."
Then they're gone. I blink for a moment at the empty space where Margot and Libby had been, and feel a shiver pass through me. Not everyone will feel the same way, I know, if the truth becomes public. For the first time, I consider that the truth is not only about Essie. It's a truth about me as well. Not the whole truth, maybe, but I'm part of the story just the same.
A prince, Margot said. Is that how people would see me? As a rescuer? A slayer of dragons? Neither of those seems right or fair. If there's any rescuing happening, it is Essie who is doing it. She has rescued herself. I have to pee, I tell the others, though really what I need to do is walk. I head down the hall toward the men's room, aware of the hum of the fluorescent lights, the muffled footfalls moving across the floors upstairs. What's above me? The kitchen alongside the refectory, maybe. I think about the church overhead. A space that has become familiar, if not altogether comfortable, over the last month. I had always thought of the building as ugly, and still do. It feels more like a sports stadium than a place of worship. There are too many spotlights, too many screens and projectors. They're necessary, I realize, because otherwise Pastor Hicks would be practically invisible to the people in the back rows. The folks like my family. But it cheapens it, I think. The glitz. The glamour. Spending more time in the church has not changed my mind about that. But I've also been here when the lights are off. When there's just the sun through the colored glass to illuminate the space. When that happens, the long strips of carpet that run the aisles are painted in every color imaginable. And the vaulted ceiling above me, with its painted cherubs, its golden stars on a backdrop of cobalt, makes me appreciate that people are capable of creating beauty, not just destroying it. Standing just before the altar where the mosaic starts, the tiny chips of stone depicting the Last Supper, I can stand on Jesus's face and look upward toward the crimson and orange and lime-tinted glow and experience something close to peace. Something like belonging. Something close to faith. I pace the hall, willing my body to remember this feeling, and slow the pounding in my chest. Psst. I hear from somewhere behind me. Rourke! In here! I catch a glimpse of Lys's face, the curve of her arm beckoning me to follow. She disappears back inside the room from which she'd called me. I creep forward, half convinced someone is watching, and then I duck inside. When I enter the room, I don't even notice Lyssa, though she must be somewhere nearby. There's only Essie, standing before me, and I can't look away. She is shimmering. That's the only way to describe it. At first, I'm not entirely certain that she's real. She takes a step forward, and the soft rustle of fabric is finally enough to convince me. You're not supposed to be here, I say too loudly. I'm not supposed to see you. Essie laughs, and it's the same tinkling sound that first made me think I could trust her. So much has happened since that day. So much has changed. But that laugh has stayed the same. I realize that I love her. I love the girl I'm about to marry. Maybe not in the way a man usually loves a woman. But I love her all the same. I think that business about not seeing each other before the ceremony only applies to real weddings, don't you? She doesn't mean this cruelly, but I'm surprised to find that I'm at least a little hurt. She must see the disappointment on my face before I can hide it, because she moves forward then and brushes her lips against my cheek. "We're above all that," is all I meant, she explains. I try to think how to tell her what I feel, but she's already saying it for me. "I love you, Rourke." I wanted to say that at least one time without the lights and cameras and people. It's not just because of what you've given me. Not just because of what you're doing for me today. You're the best friend I could ever hope for. And I don't ever want that to change. I put my hands on either side of Essie's face and lean my lips against her forehead. She slides her own hands up to cover mine.